There's just a couple more things that I want to get into. Snyder has written much about the primitive. Certainly he's perhaps our leading light on not only the concept of bioregionalism, but living a life of a real bioregionalist, living close to the land. You know, talk about the primitive. And we can surely give D'Angulo credit for sort of pointing him in that direction. But the primitive is described how to live free of the state of internal police systems, accumulated capital, military force, church dogma, and the monetizing of education, medicine, and power. And when we think of that, you know, if you ask someone, would you want to live a primitive life? They would say no. But then you describe this, and you're thinking, this sounds pretty good right about now.
Free of capital.
Well, there.
And the police state.
And, you know, the notion, the monetizing of education. What has happened with the student loans? I mean, more student loan debt than credit card debt in this country. So Snyder's influence, and of course on the Pacific Coast, is one aspect of this. But this is what you say about Pacific Coast culture in the book. It's characterized by the search for primitive mind, encounter with wilderness, a sharp investigation of what language is and how it works, a deep spiritual hunger, alert to Asian and native traditions, anarcho-pacifist politics, a hunger for the origins of song, poetry, the old forms of spiritual search, as well as intimacy with one's bioregion. And this is, you know, we already talked about Del MoMA, you know, and Snyder, we get a sense of how influential he has been. And, you know, we talk about the rucksack revolution and other things. Could you elaborate a little bit more on his direct influence on this, on the culture of the Left Coast?
Well, it would be very hard to measure his direct influence because his reputation was so underground for so long, or I should say, you know, really was spread by word of mouth, and he was himself sort of the center of a cycle of lore. He was close with Jack Spicer, very close with Robert Duncan. Many people in the literary world heard of him first through Gary Snyder, who wrote a review of Indian Tales in 1953 or 54 when the book came out. I see it maybe less Angulo's influence than that he, as Believerson would say, he embodied the archetype, that there is an archetypal West Coast writer who you could say, you know, it was defined maybe not by all of those characteristics, but some of them certainly. The encounter with wilderness, something you don't get among, you know, in Baltimore or New York City. A turn towards Asia and Native America and a sort of progressive turning away from Europe as your cultural influence. I think what I call a Gnostic relationship to wisdom and religion, that the Left Coast has tended not to be Orthodox Christianity. When it is Christian inflected, it tends to be more Gnostic or a kind of mystical Catholicism, and then of course Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, Native or indigenous religions coming in, and this sharp interrogation of language, I think, because of the linguistic diversity of the Left Coast. And if you ever go look at a map of language families for North America, indigenous or native language families, it's quite remarkable because families like what's now called Diné, used to be Athabascan, or Algonquian, or Inupiaq, are huge swaths that cover hundreds of thousands of square miles for, you know, these major language families. And then you look at the Left Coast from about San Diego up to a little bit north of here, and it's really a patchwork quilt. Not just languages, but language families. California may have had, Angulo estimated 218 different languages just in what we now call California. And that would be 218 mutually unintelligible languages. So, you know, I think all of these are characteristics that you find clustered in Angulo's work. I'd also like to say that the word primitive. I was at pains to redefine it there because it's a word that's not really much used in anthropology as being too loaded, possibly derogatory or something. That's for another generation to work through. Mm-hmm. But I like to etymologize it and take it back to, you know, like a prime mind, or what in Zen is called an original mind. That the primitive would be, you know, really one's original mind, and doesn't have to do with quality of living or, you know, particular development of culture. But Angulo is the one who recognized immediately that the people who may have visually the least developed material culture may have the richest language and lore of storytelling, ritual, ceremony, songs, jokes, autobiographies. In other words, it seems that the cultures that have been judged as primitive as having the least amount of material may, in fact, have the greatest internal life.
Right. Hence Rothenberg's phrase, technicians of the sacred, for example, you know, talking about the where the real energy went in these cultures.
Right, and Rothenberg opens that anthology, his preface or preface there. He says, primitive means complex. And that's what Angulo would say. He would say, optative, subjunctive, interrogative, volitional future, volitional present. Who calls these things simple, these languages? And in particular, his view of Pitt River language, which he loved and was very excited to discover was a tonal language like Chinese, and that it really was much more like singing. And that made it very hard for him to learn it, because like Chinese, it's not just a question of pronouncing the phonemes, but you need the tonations right. And add to that that Pitt River, like a great many Native American languages, I'm familiar with Arapaho, but everything seems to be done with the verb. Things that we break out into all these little bits and pieces in English, prepositions and pronouns and numbers and tenses and, you know, are all done in the verb. You know, I know from studying Arapaho that you use a different formation of the verb if it's a man that's running than it's a horse that's running than a dog that's running, if you can imagine it. You know, these things are all a little bit like our EDs or INGs or NESSs in English, which don't have any meaning on their own. They're linguistically meaningful, but they don't show up on their own. You can't go around speaking to somebody saying ing, ed, ness, ton, you know, these are all pieces that go into our language. And so this is the way that these highly, what were in those days called synthetic languages or agglutinative languages, and very based around the verbs, and then you add in the tonations, and very, very complex. And Angulo thought they were like singing.
Last question. You put his work on the level of Leaves of Grass or the Cantos?
I would put his Indian tales, or what were the broadcasts at, it's a complicated one, because the broadcasts he did for KPFA in the last year of his life show up in three really different ways. The manuscripts he and Robert Duncan put together, which are like projective verse, 100 broadcasts that he did over Pacifica Radio. He was writing these things as he was giving the broadcasts. He was one of the original shows on Pacifica Radio. And then the book Indian Tales, which Angulo would send his manuscripts to Ezra Pound at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington. And eventually, after Angulo's death, Pound and Marianne Moore and William Carlos Williams and others had not been able to get the book placed, and Ezra Pound gave the manuscript of Indian Tales to a young Allen Ginsberg, who went up to New York City and knew a guy working in publishing named Carl Solomon, who is the dedicatee of Howell. And Carl Solomon was working for this publishing house, A.A. Wynn, and A.A. Wynn, 3 years later, brought out Indian Tales, much reduced, and marketed it as a children's book. So they took out all the adult material. They took out anything that would bore the Indians, like how you dress an elk and how you cure the hide. They took out all the linguistic material. They took out most of the songs. And the songs weren't really in there except in Angulo's kind of notation for singing, but you get those on the broadcast. So in some way, this here would be like, best hits from Leaves of Grass or the selected cantos for children.
Right.
And the real work is the broadcast tapes combined with the manuscripts, which are also full of his illustrations and a kind of projective laying out of the language, which also has phonetic spelling. He thought we Americans and the British are idiots for keeping all sorts of obsolete spellings. You know, knight, N-I-G-H-T. Sure, we can say historically it comes from, you know, some Proto-Germanic that's like nicht or something, but why have the kids waste their time spelling these idiotic spellings that have no relevance when they could be learning other things? Make spelling easier. So he always argued for phonetic spelling, and he spelled it F-O-N-E-T-I-K. And there's a wonderful letter from Marianne Moore where she says, Jaime, it's going to be hard enough to get your manuscripts published as they are, they're so unorthodox, but this phonetic spelling business. And Dorothy Pound also said, you know, ordinarily I'm not much of a fan of creative spelling, but with Jaime's work, it's part of the work. It captures his personality. And so Dorothy Pound was outraged and shocked when A.A. Wynn regularized all spelling.
This is, you've been excellent listeners, so I would open it up to questions. We have time if anyone has questions. I always have questions, but we don't have to fill up the time. I should say that Jason Wirth is here, and without Jason's involvement, Andrew would not have come to town. And you'll be reading tomorrow night at Seattle U, 7:30 at
Student Center, room 130.
Student Center, room 130. And you'll be reading poetry tomorrow night.
Yes.
So you'll be reading from your latest translations from the Sanskrit.
I'll read poetry, I'll read translations from the Sanskrit, and I will talk a little bit about Buddha Dharma and the old Sanskrit and in contemporary American poetry, yes.
Yeah. So there you have it.
Free and open to the public.
Free and open to the public.
What
and
time was that?
7:30 tomorrow night.
It's ground floor of the Student Center.
So, no questions. Well, there's a question. No, I see three. Okay, yes. As soon as I'm going to wrap this up.
Do those broadcasts survive? Are they in the Pacific Archive?
They are. It used to be very hard to find them. I think they're better organized down there than they used to be. And they've been migrated. They were 100 broadcasts originally on reel-to-reel tape. At some point, Guy, Heidi's daughter, Guy, she now goes Guy by Mayo, Guy Mayo, went in and edited them and reduced them to 88 tapes. Those were eventually migrated to cassettes, and the cassettes eventually migrated to CDs and digitized, and I think you can purchase the CDs if you want. I think you can find some, if not all, of the broadcasts online through the Pacifica Archives. I recommend buying the CDs, but they are $20 each, and there's 22 of them, so you know that's a real outlay of money to get the full set of them. And Pacifica Radio, or at least KPFA, will routinely rebroadcast them. When I listened to them in the 1980s, it was quite fun because they do two Angulo broadcasts, and they use up a half an hour doing that, and then they run it back to back with another Left Coast culture hero, Alan Watts.
Question in the back, sir. Did you have a question? You, yeah.
I had a small comment. You were going along with so many places. Really loved the opening reading. Just so much richness about what you put in there. Your mind can go off in a lot of different directions. So I just really appreciate that. But just recalling reading a letter that Jaime wrote to Ezra Pound using the kind of spelling that you're talking about, and here are these two linguistic geniuses, and it sounds like a really simple simpletons talking, but there's an inner richness about how that spelling act is going on and what's being said. It just called that to mind. I just love that. And now, is there a longer Indian Tales version somehow written up that includes more of that material?
There is. Well, back in the 70s, Bob Callahan published two little volumes in the Angulo Library that were episodes and pieces left out.
Part of that seven you were mentioning?
Yeah, part of that seven. And they were boxed together, two little volumes, one called Shabagak. Shabagak is the name of a Pomo village on Clear Lake, or a former Pomo village. And the other was called How the World Was Made, and is effectively the great Pomo telling by Angulo's good friend William Roginal Benson of the Pomo creation myth, I guess you could call it. And there were two versions of How the World Was Made. One that Jaime and Roginal published in, I think it was American Anthropologist, and it included, I think it was bilingual for some of the way, and they struggled to keep the English in the order of Pomo words. Jaime rewrote it and retold it late in life as How the World Was Made, but it's an episode from the longer Indian tale. So
was that used in the sheltered book that the Whole Earth Catalog put out? Do you happen to know that one?
I don't know, but I bet it was. And it's a great telling with, the Kuksu and Silver Fox having to make the world and then destroy the world because people are misbehaving, and they create and destroy the world four times until they get it.
That's what I'm calling. Yeah.
More or less right. I mean, of course, Coyote fucks it up always, and Kuksu is Coyote, but but anyhow, it's a great retelling. But as far as the whole thing goes, it's not available in manuscript. You could go down to UCLA possibly and photocopy it, but now they charge like $1 a page to photocopy things, and the manuscripts are a mess. So it's for another scholar to get that stuff together. Thanks for asking, though. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Dale Pendel, and we didn't get a chance to mention that he passed. He died about a month ago.
Yeah, he died about a month ago.
Reference the journal, the bi-regional journal you're talking about. Did I see any other questions? I did not. So, it's just an honor to be at a bookstore like this and to be able to present, such brilliant material. And, it's obvious that it's 40 years of work. It comes through. And what also comes through, as was noted with the reading, is that the work itself is very projective. When you read that book, it sounds like poetry, and it works just fine at poetry readings. And, it's a very rare skill to be able to write like that, to be able to sift through such material like that, and to get the essence of it as you have. It's really admirable and remarkable, and I'm really grateful that you came to town and were able to come and talk to us about this. So thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Paul. Yeah, thank you, Paul and Jason, for hosting me and bringing me up here. Yeah.
A hand for Andrew Shaw. Will you be signing books if anyone buys books?
Of course.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll sign in the back. And thank you, Elliot Bay, and thank you all for coming.